It is 6 minutes after the hour. Wait a second. No, it's 26, 25, 20, 26 minutes after the hour. I'm having trouble with clocks and the internet today, so this should be interesting.
It's your internet. It's your internet.
It could be.
To misread the clock.
I'm not on cosmic time, obviously, here. So, Pastor Robbie Brewitt joins us. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, a member of the board, actually the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, and lives in Ashburn, Virginia, where he has a church that got... How's the flood damage coming there in your sanctuary there, Robbie?
Thanks for having me on, Jim. And David, good to be with you. And yeah, we're still, dealing with the repercussions of the water damage in our chapel there. It happens.
Man. It would have been a great opportunity for a baptism or two, I would have figured.
But. Yeah,
it
reminds us of the days of...
Are we going we might be intermittent on the internet here, so an intermittent internet, that's kind of tough to say. But Robbie's here, and we're going to be talking about Luke. We've been kind of exploring the whole book of Luke for a few weeks here, and we're into Luke 14, and the question of humility comes up. And I'm looking at Luke, and there are a number of things here. There's the episode at the Pharisee's house where there's a healing on the Sabbath. There's the great banquet, the cost of being a disciple. Most all of that just crosses my eyes, Robbie. I'm not sure what's going on, especially with that parable of the great banquet. Is that what you had in mind today?
Yeah, I mean, even leading up to that, taking the lowly place. And the key verse here, I believe, is whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. That's Luke 14:11.
Mm-hmm.
This issue of humility, and Jesus is telling a parable, again, right after he heals on the Sabbath. And what I'm seeing here in the healing, right at the beginning of chapter 4 in Luke's gospel, is a pridefulness in the Pharisees that assume they have it all right. And Jesus even questions, because even the Pharisees and the Sadducees, not the Essenes, who were a little bit more observant and detail-oriented around issues of Sabbath, but the Pharisees and the Sadducees, if they have an animal that falls into a pit or a ditch, will you not pull it out? Now, it's not uncommon in the first century to dig cisterns for water and to dig pits to trap animals in it. Hmm. And sometimes the domestic animals would get trapped there in the Sabbath and be at risk and danger to themselves. So, of course, even if it's on the Sabbath and you have an animal in danger, won't you pull that animal out? Now, this is Jesus's response to the Pharisees and Sadducees, who were pridefully elevating themselves, thinking that they had the law all figured out. And he's telling this parable to say, of course you're going to help somebody on the Sabbath. That's what I just did.
Well, he was watching them take their seat around a banquet table. And each seat had a specific role in terms of hierarchy, didn't it, in those things? Like the guest of honor would sit to the right of the host, not to the left. That would be a lesser honor. And you go around, for example, a triclinium table, three sides, which was kind of standard for those upper crust get-togethers. The lowliest position was the last seat clockwise. Like Peter at the Last Supper. So he was watching that, and then he had some comments. And that's how this parable pops up about the great banquet.
Yeah, the triclinium table, it's what you see in John 13 when Jesus does wash his disciples' feet. You're absolutely right. So the certain seating arrangement shows your prominence. For example, me as a wedding guest would never sit at the bride and groom's table unless I was the father of the bride. I wouldn't do it. And so we have these protocols even today about who is of most importance in the room, and then we put them in a place of prominence. So Jesus is walking into this dining situation, this breaking of bread on the Sabbath day, right out of the gate in Luke 14. And there is someone, and I think this is, I think this happened, but it's also a literary device that's happening here, because this person has what's called dropsy, or what we would know as edemia today. It's this swelling. It's like a sign of actually a heart issue where you're collecting water around your ankles, edema, and it swells and gets puffed up and painful. This is called dropsy. And so you get this sense of all the people who are puffed up in the room, either in their seats of prominence or puffed up in their illness, this swelling, this painful swelling up. You've heard the expression, don't let your head get too big.
Mm-hmm.
And an expression of pride or
puffed up. There's another room, yeah.
Yeah, to be puffed up. And, you know, you probably don't have that problem, Jim. I certainly don't. I'm the humblest person I know.
Well, you know what? I think you're the humblest person I know and one of the most giving and with the biggest heart. But, and you know, I've had a...
This would be a time we could do a chorus of our favorite song, Jim.
Kumbaya? Yeah,
It's oh so hard to be humble.
Oh yeah.
When we're perfect in every way.
No, that's true. Right. I remember
Willie Nelson.
It wasn't Willie Nelson. It was Mac Davis.
That's right. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble. You're perfect.
Oh Lord.
Hey. Well, that's
the chorus is. But I'm trying my best.
Yeah, and that's the Pharisee song. I mean, really, that's the Pharisee song. And anybody who assumes that they don't have an issue with pride or that they're good to go, they're humble enough, I mean, that is an
indicator. Well, the scene is a banquet here, and you can just imagine the Pharisees jockeying for the favored position because they each consider themselves above somebody in the group. No, you sit over there. And the host would have charge of that, would he not?
Exactly. The host is seating people, and they are putting the people in order and they're prominent. So when you walk in the room, you know where you stand socially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the context of the first century at a banquet like this. And I'm curious. I wonder where Jesus is seated.
That's a good question. Because they were all watching him, it says here. They were all watching to see what he would do. I'm guessing, this is totally hypothetical. I'm not hypothetical, but totally a guess, that they put him someplace and wondered how he would react, maybe at a lesser position.
Right. Or a prominent position to watch him squirm. I don't know if you've been in this situation. I have. I've got a handful of stories. In my line of work, you get invited to things as a priest. And I don't know that I deserve to be in any of those places, but I find myself in them, I think, because of my position. I remember getting invited to an FCA fundraising banquet, and a friend of mine was the director, and he said, oh, your seat's over here. I thought I would be seated with my church, who had a table in the back of the room, but sat me down towards the platform, and I struck up a conversation with, hey, how did you get to this banquet? And the guy leaned over to me. I know who he is now, Steve Fitzhugh. He said, well, I'm the speaker tonight.
Yeah.
And I realized, I was like, what am I doing here? And so it's an interesting position. Or if you go into a room and you don't know.
See what you do when you get that, you just tell him, hey, I've read all your books. You know.
That's right. The problem is, I don't know that at the time he had written any. And you've been in this situation too, where you thought it was okay to be somewhere, and someone said, "Excuse me, sir, I'm so sorry. You need to leave," and you realize that you were where you shouldn't be, and that's a humiliating situation. I think humiliation is when you are put in a position of humility that you may or may not have chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore you're humiliated. So it could be either. I mean, it doesn't spell out where Jesus is in this text, but it is an interesting question to wonder, where is he? Where is he seated?
Well, it might have been because of his previous reputation that they were focused on him, watching to see what he would do, what he would say. It's interesting to note, too, that they must have figured they would learn not just about him, but maybe learn from him at the same time, because he had really a pretty high reputation with the people at this point in his ministry. And then he goes to this parable of the great banquet, which really exaggerates pride and humility, does it not?
It does. I mean, and I would let's not get quite to the parable of the great banquet before we go through the parable of taking the lowly place.
Okay.
Jesus is saying, he tells this parable, so we know it's a parable. It's in the text, verse 7. And he noted how some of them in the room were choosing the better places. And he says, when you were invited in the parable, he says there are people who are choosing the prominent place. He says, when you are invited, and this is a teaching here, when anyone is invited to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest the one more honorable be invited and come in, and you have to give your place up. So this is the context of what Jesus says, which is kind of the crux of the matter. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So then he also told to them, to some of the who invited him, he said, when you give a dinner or supper, do not ask your friends or your brothers or your relatives. So now it's like, who do you invite to the supper? Because in this culture, the more guests you have at your feast, the more honorable you become. So by throwing a big party, it exalts the host. So Jesus is saying, when you go to a dinner or supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, your neighbors, lest you be invited back. In other words, go get the people who can't, with you being honored and giving them this gift of this meal or this feast, don't invite the people who are going to invite you back to honor you in exchange. So this social hierarchy is all about honor, and it's about the host being honored, and in a mutual reciprocity, the expectation is I invited you to my house for dinner and gave you this seat of prominence. You now need to invite me to your banquet and put me in a similar seat or better. So Jesus says, invite the lame, the poor, the people with dropsy, in other words.
Honor and shame really do enter into this. So the whole honor shame thing is that if you're shamed, you need to overshame the person who shamed you to get more than even. This is not a zero-sum deal. Same thing with the other way around. If someone treats you with honor, then you need to outdo that and invite him back and put him back in a higher place of honor at the table. So this reciprocity thing is complicates it. And also because meals were a very special occasion. Eating together was, it's big in our culture, but it was huge in first century Israel, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And this is the setup for the parable of the Great Supper, which you could look at immediately as the Great Marriage Supper of the Lamb, the final heavenly feast.
The wedding feast, yeah.
Yeah, and it begins with verse 15. It says, now when one of those who sat at the table, so this is historical narrative here, with him heard his teaching, this last parable we just discussed, he said to him, blessed is he who shall eat the bread in the kingdom of heaven. So he understands that the kingdom of heaven is the living out of this parable. It's God who invites all of us, poor, lame, and broken, maimed, the blind, and people who can't repay God's generosity for inviting us into his feast and putting us at his place of prominence. See, we are the desired guest that Jesus is telling this parable about. We're supposed to see ourselves as the blind, the lame, the broken, the poor, the maimed, and the lame. This is our condition, and the Master has invited us into his feast, and we can't repay him. So what's our posture when we throw a banquet? Grab the richest and the best and the brightest and the most educated and the most socially hierarchy, like the highest of the high in the social hierarchy, because if we invite them, now they can come back to they will invite us back to their house and bless us.
So we do that to elevate ourselves.
Yeah. And so we are not the elevated host here. We are the impoverished guest at the kingdom feast.
question here, and this is kind of historic and cultural context both. One of the people at the table said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast of the king in the kingdom of God." Did the Hebrew culture have this idea of a wedding feast also at some point in the end times? I'm not sure what their eschatology was like before Jesus introduced the kingdom of God. Or was he trying to flatter Jesus by saying, "I've been listening to you teach. Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." What do you suppose was on his mind? And I know this is kind of iffy.
It's a little bit conjecture. But, you know, it's the cultural artifacts that we have, the words that dictate the culture. So, in other words, you and I might express what heaven looks like. We might use the words like, you know, Disney World in the sky or something, you know, I mean, just something that we can think of, the most magical kingdom we can imagine, and we transfer that upon heaven. Well, to the Jew, a feast or a wedding feast is one of the most enjoyable, joy-filled occasion of blessing and feasting. It would sometimes go, you know, seven days. So when you think about what's the pinnacle of joy, it's a wedding and it's marital bliss and it's all these things. And so this is superimposed. The power, the weight of it is there. Whether or not they envisioned, you know, a banqueting table or marriage supper of the Lamb as we would know it or think about it in Revelation, because that book isn't written yet here. We do know that they have this same imagery and these same hopes eschatologically.
We know that the Hebrew wedding tradition is stressed throughout the Gospels. I mean, it's brought up time and time and time again. And it even conforms to Old Testament practices in terms of how you propose to a bride and the dowry and the trousseau and how the groom goes away to build a house. And so all this must have been familiar to them, even in the pre-Christian culture.
Yeah. So now it sets up the parable that Jesus tells of the great supper. If this supper is so important, you're going to want to be there. In other words, if you get an invitation to come to the pinnacle of pinnacles of all great suppers, you're going to carve out time in your schedule to be there. And what we see is the opposite, because the people are being invited and they're giving excuses as to why they cannot come. So they are dishonoring the invitation. So he said to them, "A certain man had a great supper and invited many, and sent his servant at supper time to say to those who were invited, 'Come, all things are ready. Right now is the time for you to come to this banquet.' But they all with one accord," in other words, they've conspired together to give their excuses at the same time. So in other words, if you say you're not coming, I'll say I'm not coming. We'll just do it all at once. It'll be uncomfortable at once. Again, won't be highlighted for our individual, "No, I can't make it." So there is an RSVP that comes in the mail for wedding feast today, and we're supposed to check the box, put it in the envelope, and send it out. If you don't do that, you're saying, "Well, it doesn't matter to me," or "I'm not even going to give you the dignity to tell you I'm not coming." Or in this case, to send your excuse. But what happens when all your guests get together? Well, if no guests come to the banquet, there is no banquet. But the expense has already been paid. The caterers, so to speak, have already been paid. The band has been booked. The venue has been booked. All of this is in place, and so these people begin to dishonor the host by giving their excuses one by one in one accord, and that's a key to this passage. The first said to them, "I bought a piece of ground. I must go and see it." That can't wait. I mean, I ask you, have me excused. Another said, I bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to test them. That can't wait. You didn't know that that was going to happen. So you get all of these excuses that are really preposterous. Still another said, I've married a wife. So in other words, I've got my own wedding feast or wedding celebration. If you just got married, you're off the hook for any invitations for the next year. You should be dedicating it to your marriage, mm-hmm. according to Jewish law. Mm-hmm. So this guy's saying, you got to let me off the hook, and this is why. And so every servant came and reported these things to his master, but the master of the house became angry, like he should. It's a big loss. It's a big dishonor. He's losing face. Go quickly into the lanes, the city, and bring the poor, the maimed. So now this parable is living out what Jesus is telling us in the previous parable.
There's some comments in the chat window, too, from D. Larry B., and he says, Jesus was calling Israel to understand that their theology erred. They had absolutely become spiritually prideful. So he was really lecturing them as the religious elite, wasn't he?
Yeah, he straightened them out. And I believe this is my good friend and bike ministry partner, Larry Bamford, over there in Fairfax City. Larry, thanks for tuning in, man. I enjoyed talking to you earlier today. You're right about this kingdom of heaven piece that God is showing these we see these parallel passages, and we're connecting this to the kingdom of God being totally different. And it's a good word.
So much more in Luke, and I'm thinking there's so much more in here than I've ever failed to notice. You know, I've skipped through Luke so many times, mainly to get to John. I have a problem with zeroing in on John. And you've in fact, over the past few weeks, you've shown many parallels between John and Luke. And and by the way, I do believe that D. Larry B. is a different regular listener to the station. Yeah. So, but a point well made, D. Larry B. Thank you for the thought.
Yeah, thanks so much, Larry. Sorry to confuse you with the other Larry. Everybody needs a good friend, Larry. You know.
Yeah, that's true. And then the cost of being a disciple, is that something for next time?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think I think we bit off more than we could chew.
Well, I think we did. I think, there's so much. And I want to mention to you the website, Preserving Bible Times, and you'll find a wealth of information that helps you understand the context, particularly to the four Gospels, but really to the whole Bible, because once you understand them, you get a clearer picture of what came before and what comes after those Gospel accounts. And you might pay them a call. PreservingBibleTimes.org. You can link to it from our site there at BrokenRoadRadio.com. And once again, Robbie, thanks so much. We've learned something. Somehow you do manage to elevate the conversation every week about this time, and we appreciate that.
Thanks for having
us. Yes, we do.
Joy to be with you all, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you later. See you, Robbie.